History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there waiting to be told. All we have to do is ask a few questions and then take the time to patiently listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out better for it because we're educated. We're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm not sure how you marked Thanksgiving this year. Chances are that in some way, maybe significant or maybe seemingly insignificant, but in some way, it was different from what Thanksgiving is usually like for you. Each and every year, there are families experiencing Thanksgiving without a certain loved one for the first time. I've been there, you probably have been too, and this year, so many of the amazing Americans you've heard on this show were absent from that Thanksgiving table for the first time. I don't always mention it on air when one of the veterans you've met here passes because typically we're spending the hour getting to know and celebrating a veteran who's still with us. But as I gathered with our family this year, I found myself thinking about some of those families, like the family of Joe Garabedian, who passed away this month at the age of 96. It was only a few months earlier that he had explained to us how close he came to losing his life in the Philippines 76 years earlier.
Zing, right through my shoulder. Mm-hmm. So it was a sniper. Later on at the Army reunions, one of the guys told me, he says, when they found the guy, they counted 60 shots. He was up in the palm tree.
Mm.
So I got up and I started running. I run about 10 feet. The blood is squirting out. I'm hollering, medics, medics. And I fell down. So my medic comes and, Garabedian, where's your medical kit? I says, it's on the Jeep. I said, I didn't want to carry it. So they gave me a shot of morphine. They patched me up. That's the only patching up I got until I got to Hoanya, New Guinea. So this is an interesting part. They managed to get me on a stretcher, and a fellow by the name of Medziak out of Chicago, he was underneath the bush. He reached down and grabbed a hold of my stretcher, and one hand pulled me underneath that bush. It took another half hour before the firing. You don't fire all day long. It just goes in spurts. So then at about 5:30 in the evening, the Jeep came by and they put three of us on and took us back 14 miles to the field hospital.
What about your arm? Did you have the use of that left arm at all?
I didn't have the use of that arm for more than a year. I was in the hospital. From that point on, I got discharged on November 45. We entered the United States and back again on the 2nd of January. Of 45. I got discharged. The end of 45, I got discharged.
Mm-hmm.
My arm was useless. Even now, when the weather gets real cold, this arm is useless because I got a 30% disability on it.
Well, it sounds almost miraculous you were ever able to use it at all.
I use it for everything.
But I'm thinking about the first 30 minutes that you're wounded, because you described it. They get you on a stretcher, but you're still out there, and they're still firing all around you, and, yeah. And your buddy's able to pull you under a bush.
I've often wondered how they got me on the stretcher, but Medziak was the only one under the bush within reach of me, and he pulled it underneath. I guess what happened was they spread out once they got me on the stretcher, and that stretcher is on legs or something, and he's a big, great big bullock, great big bullock. He grabbed me and pulled me underneath.
What do you think would have happened to you if he didn't do that?
They would have nailed me.
Not only did Joe Garabedian come home and overcome his injuries, he founded a welding and machine business with his brothers that endures today, with his children and grandchildren carrying on his legacy and producing custom machines for agricultural applications all around the world. I'm so thankful we got to hear Joe's amazing story when we did. And so was the daughter of that fellow wounded soldier who saved Joe's life in 1944 by pulling him under the bush for cover. Tony Medziak never told his daughter anything about how he was wounded, but in listening to Joe's memories, she received details she never would have been able to learn otherwise. The day after we lost Joe Garabedian this month, Lou Goodman passed away in San Luis Obispo, California, where he had become a fixture at the Spirit of San Luis restaurant at the airport there, treating friends and sometimes strangers to breakfast every weekend. Lou was a bombardier on B-17s with the 91st Bomb Group during World War II, and he shared one memory of his plane being shot up, two crew members severely wounded, the navigator informing the crew that they had two options, ditch in the English Channel or try to make it back to their base, even though they might not be able to muster enough altitude to clear those white cliffs of Dover.
Took a vote. It was unanimous. We're going to stick together one way or another. We're going to make it or not make it, but we're not going to ditch it in that cold channel. We're not going to lose those two guys for sure.
Right.
So as it turned out, those two guys...
Yeah.
Went to the hospital. They never came back to the war, but they both lived. They both lived. And but if we had a ditch in that channel, they wouldn't have lived.
So that was really the decision point.
Yeah.
Because you guys can ditch in the channel. You know the water's cold.
Very cold.
You don't know how long it's going to take for someone to find you.
Right.
And because of their injuries, you guys were convinced they wouldn't survive.
They wouldn't survive. They won't survive in that cold water. And they couldn't help themselves. They were unconscious, you know. So he said they won't make it.
So the other eight of you risked your lives.
We voted.
You voted, and your decision was basically to risk your lives on the chance that you might not make it over the cliffs in order to save those two.
Yeah, and also... ditching in the channel wasn't a real safe thing to do, you know.
Right.
We could have died there, too, but we elected, you know. And all eight guys start praying. All eight guys start praying. That's why not only my mother's prayers, but other places. I am a strong believer in prayer. I'm a strong believer. Now, God doesn't always answer our prayers, Paul. He doesn't always answer our prayers. Here a month ago, I was in severe pain. I was having terrible, terrible pain. And I prayed to the Lord to take me home. Take me, Lord. Please take me right now. He didn't do it. You know why? Because I still had work for him to do. So I believe in prayer, but your prayers are not always going to be answered, but most of the time they will be. Okay. I preached enough today to you. Okay.
Anyone who met Lou in recent years heard similar things. In fact, Marshall Humes, the retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who introduced me to Lou, shared that the last thing Lou said to him the night before he passed this month at the age of 96 was, quote, "Never underestimate the power of prayer." You can link to the complete interviews with Lou Goodman and Joe Garabedian at hometownheroesradio.com. And you can also access our conversation with Frank Macon. It made national headlines this week when Frank passed away at the age of 97 in his native Colorado Springs, Colorado. Frank Macon was one of the last surviving Tuskegee Airmen from World War II. I want you to hear some of his story today, and the book that he wrote 2 years ago might be a perfect Christmas gift for someone in your life, not to mention a fitting way to perpetuate his unique legacy.
I was raised by two great aunts and an uncle. It was really great. I had a lot of fun and got into a lot of mischief, just like all the rest of the kids in the neighborhood. In fact, the book was written about some of the kids, and I always say that in the neighborhood, and I sit on the porch and I just told them they shouldn't do those things. But I got blamed for everything that happened in the neighborhood. There was a thing that the people in the neighborhood said, that boy, Ms. Macon's, will never live to be 21 because of the mischief that he's getting and the things that he was doing. And I fooled him.
I guess you did, because you don't even look 96 as we're sitting here talking. And as far as you getting blamed for everything, did you feel that was because of racial prejudice or just they didn't want to take the blame?
No, it was because I did. I did it then.
So you weren't as innocent as it sounded there, huh?
No, I wasn't. And the neighborhood that I grew up in, I still live in it, but anyway, it was very diverse as far as racial comes. There were Mexicans and very, very, very few blacks or colored or Negro or however they termed us in those days. And a lot of whites, and everybody was of a lower middle class, and they all had to work, and there were gold miners and coal miners and ranchers, all of that, and that's who I grew up around. And people that were very innovative because the Depression was on, you know. Mm-hmm. And we had to forge for ourselves, and they did very well.
Well, and I've talked to a lot of people who lived through the Depression and the perspective that they have as a result. But I'm just trying to imagine where we are back in those days, because you're right by Interstate 25, but that wasn't here yet.
The highway to Denver was just a two-lane road, and part of it was paved and part of it wasn't. Of course, the railroad tracks were there, and the highway came in several years after the war.
Well, and I'm just imagining, I mean, the stories you hear about the Depression, people have a hard time finding enough food to eat, let alone gas for a car. And in this part of the country, at this altitude, you get a heck of a lot of snow. That couldn't have been easy to deal with in those days.
Well, yeah, but we survived, and everybody depended on everybody. In the fall of the year, they went deer hunting. The kids in the neighborhood, they would hang the carcasses up, and they would skin them, and we would have to scrape the hides. They would sell them for a whopping $5 a piece. And if you planted a garden, most of the neighborhood went with pitchforks and helped you dig up and plant the garden, and then you'd help the next one sit. So there was a lot of cooperation. We didn't see, as they have now, people standing on the corners with signs that please help. We took care of each other. Of course, they had things like the government finally came up with programs to put people to work, WPA and things like that. In 1935, around Labor Day, we had a flood that took out a lot of the neighborhood, and the creek that caused all the problems, they got out and widened it. And it was basically done by hand, so to speak. A drawbar hooked to horses and things like that. Mm. And we widened the creek and put, if you'd see alongside the embankment, they've got rock. And all this was done up in the mountains. They built new reservoirs and highways and things like that. And people actually went to work. They just were not laying around asking somebody to take care of them or the government or anything like that. They were just used to doing that.
And I understand you became interested in aviation at a very young age. Is that right?
Oh, yes. There was an aircraft factory that was up in the north end of town, and it was called Alexander Aircraft. They built the Eagle Rock and the Eagle Rock Bullet. Every chance I could get, I'd sneak up there and watch them build the airplanes. And the factory finally had to shut down because of the Depression. But they had the airfield up, and they would take the aircraft across the road, which was the highway, over there to the little airfield, and they would do some testing and flying them. And, some of the airplanes were successful, and they had a little problems with some of the others.
Yeah, I think people forget how primitive aviation was then. I mean, you're only a couple decades into the existence of aircraft. But so that young, you dreamed of being a pilot someday?
Well, yes, and they would take me flying, and they saw that I had expressed a great interest in the aircraft, but it was the mechanics of the aircraft that I was interested in, as well as the flying.
So what was the first aircraft you ever went up in, and what did that feel like?
Well, as I stated in the book, there was a family that lived, the Warden family that lived next door to me, and they had been ranchers and they had moved to town. And there was two girls there, and these girls were dating some of the pilots up there. And when my folks had to go to work or something, well, they would babysit me, and they would just take me out there at the airport with them, and I was setting up there flying with them. And I didn't realize, you know, no big deal. And So I got to very early age. And then, of course, I was trying to build my own wings and jumped off the chicken house and trying to fly. And I didn't have very successful landings.
I was going to say, how did that work when you jumped off the chicken coop?
Not very successful. It's a good thing the ground was plowed underneath.
And that little airfield you're talking about, where you got your first taste of flying, I believe they're still using that area for aviation today. Maybe a different scale a little bit?
Yeah, that's where the Air Force Academy teaches their glider pilots. It was called Pine Valley Airport. They're going to rename it to Benjamin Davis Field. And, of course, as a Tuskegee Airman, we go out and talk to the cadets a lot. And I tell them this is where I made my first successful solo in high school is off this field.
And for people who aren't familiar, you're very familiar with the name that you just said, Benjamin Davis. But for people who don't know who that is, why don't you explain his significance?
This Benjamin Davis was his father was one of the first black generals. And, of course, he went to West Point. And then there's quite a story about him and how they didn't talk to him the whole time he was there. But anyway, then he took over and learned to fly. And when they started teaching the black pilots to fly, it's quite a story about how that all came about. And most of the military didn't want Roosevelt to authorize the service. And Mrs. Roosevelt, she pushed for him to do it, and I called her the mother of black aviation because she really forced it. And then she went down and flew with one of the pilots down there at Tuskegee. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a story. You could read about it. Pappy Anderson, as we called him, and she flew with him. And then she come back, and the Secret Service didn't want her to do it, and called him and tried. He said, "Well, I can't tell her anything. And she's going to do it. She's going to do it." So, that was that. You know, of course, the success that Tuskegee Airmen had overseas was is well documented.
Yes, of course. Books, documentaries, the feature film Red Tails that you may have seen. There's a wealth of material chronicling the contributions of the Tuskegee Airmen during World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, I have linked for you an article from the FDR Library about Eleanor Roosevelt's early support for African-American aviation. And to elaborate on Frank's comments about General Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., the man for whom the airstrip where Frank Macon first flew is named, Davis was the leader of the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II, commanding the 332nd Fighter Group and personally flying 60 missions in P-39s, P-40s, P-47s, and P-51s. There's no shortage of heroics from those pioneering pilots, of course, but Davis took great pride in the spotless record of Red Tail escorts. Not a single bomber was ever lost when being escorted by the Tuskegee Airmen over more than 200 missions in the skies over Europe. Eventually, Davis would become the first African-American general in the history of the Air Force. He's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. A barracks is named in his honor at West Point, where, as Frank mentioned, Davis was once ostracized for the color of his skin. Davis passed away in 2002, but his autobiography is a great read. It's titled Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., American. It underscores his desire to be measured by his character and what he accomplished. To succeed as an American, as the book's jacket states, and not to fail because of color. So you might want to add that book to your list, along with Frank Macon's book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot. It's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to hear more of the story in the book and more of the story behind the book when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable. Or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it.
Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and an opportunity this week to reflect on some veterans who have left us this month, including Tuskegee Airman Frank Macon, who passed away November 22nd at the age of 97 in his native Colorado Springs. While still in high school, he had already soloed from an airstrip, which now belongs to the Air Force Academy. But as bright as he was and as accomplished as he was, he had some major challenges to overcome. And one of the reasons his book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, was written was to encourage others in similar circumstances. Here's what Frank said when I asked him how he was doing in school during those years.
Terrible. I'm very dyslexic, and they didn't understand that problem that people that are dyslexic have. And now they, of course, they're farther advanced in it, and they're helping a lot. But I did have a very good memory, so that helped a lot. I learned by the words would move around on the paper in a book or something, and numbers were just terrible. And if I put my finger on them and use my finger, I could stabilize the words a lot better. And so that's how I learned to read.
But you kind of had to figure that all out on your own? No one was helping you?
Yeah, I just figured it out on my own. But anyway, it was really strange. Today, I can't figure out how I passed those tough tests that they gave us to be able to fly, but a lot of the questions they asked had to do with science and physics, and I really enjoyed physics and chemistry and auto mechanics and the things that we did in, I'll say, junior high school and high school here in Colorado Springs, and I got quite a good education in that field, and physics was one of my favorite subjects, and how things work, and it just always amazes me, even today, how the Creator put this world and the whole creation together. Many years later, I'm jumping ahead, I retired from civil service at Fort Carson, and I was asked to join a research company. I'm just awed by how wonderful this world and the creation, and it just amazes me how the trees know when to turn, when to put the leaves on, when to drop them, and just all of that. I'm just like a little 10-year-old kid. I'm just always amazed at everything
Well, there's a lot of scenery around here that can amaze you too. You said you've been in this neighborhood pretty much your whole life, and Pike's Peak, I think we could throw a rock to if we had a good enough arm out your back porch here, and the Garden of the Gods not too far away. I guess there's a question, too, just out of curiosity. Did you have much opportunity to explore the nature around here as a boy?
Oh, yeah. We were always hiking the mountains and whatnot and picking up different minerals. Of course, the grade school I went to, this neighborhood was either gold miners or coal miners. Of course, there was always an argument which one of them was a miner, but they expected us to fall in line with our parents in the mining industry. Geology, I learned a lot just because they felt that we were going to be miners.
You were talking about how good your memory is, so I've got to ask you about December 7th, 1941, because most of the people I've met who are alive then have some kind of memory of how they found out what happened out at Pearl Harbor. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Well, what I remember is, as I said, I always wanted to be a pilot. I was driving a 14 probably dying before then because, but anyway, my great uncle just went down to the police station. He couldn't drive, and my mama had arthritis real bad. And he asked, so that kid knows how to drive, is all right if he's driving? And they said, oh, yeah, as long as somebody's with him. Now, I took them to a friend's house. I don't know. I was just driving around with the car. There's a girl that used to live in the neighborhood, and I went by to see her, and she says, well, I guess you're going to be a pilot now. And I said, what? And she says, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And I said, what's that? You know, I never heard of Pearl Harbor. And that's how I actually got involved. Of course, turned the old car radio on, and between the static and whatnot, and they would talk about that. I joined the Civil Air Patrol, and then this is where I really started learning about airplanes, and they would take us flying and teach us how to manipulate the controls, you know. My coordination was always been good. I was on the tumbling team and things like that, you know. And when I graduated from high school, they said they've started a new program in the colleges and started teaching. They told me about Tuskegee. I never heard of it, but, you know, and it was in Flying Magazine. They told me that I could go to there, the college, and the government would pay for it, you know. And I had to go to the new Customs House in Denver and take the test to see if I could qualify. They wanted to put me in the Army Air Corps, and I said, well, I'm supposed to go to the civilian pilot training program. And they called me in and said, you're too young. You have to be 21 to get a commercial license. And so they sent me home. Even after I'd gotten out of school, I would not have been 21, you know. So I came back, went back to work at the old garage, working on automobiles. So the draft board started looking at me, and I went back, took the test, and I got in and got, and then went to Keister Field. Boy, oh, there was some tough tests, and a lot of was about your physical and coordination and whatnot. But you had to have 2 years of college to go to flight school. Well, I just got out of high school, so they sent me to Tuskegee to college. I was there a little while, and I don't know, 3 or 4 months. They sent me to Maxwell Field to take the test again, and they said, well, you more than qualified for 2 years of college. And so then they sent me to the base.
And I'm just curious, because this is, you know, most of the people listening weren't alive during that time period, and maybe they've heard some stories, but they didn't live through it. The fact that our nation's military at the time was segregated, that Japanese Americans were isolated over here, that African Americans weren't serving with whites in the same unit. How did that strike you? Did that disturb you? Did it seem odd, or was that the way things were then?
I wasn't used to being down south, and I wasn't used to that because the school I went to was integrated. Native Americans, Mexicans, and blacks were all, and along Irish and everybody else was, you know. And so it was just really confusing to me. And water, I had to go into this bathroom or a toilet, you know, facility. Or I couldn't drink out of this fountain and all of that. And it was just really ridiculous. And I had just never been involved in anything like that.
And, of course, a lot of these pilots that you're studying with and training with had grown up in the South and had a much different experience. How eye-opening was that for you to glean some of what they'd been through?
The thing was that, well, I couldn't understand anything they were saying, and they couldn't understand anything I was saying. When they found out I came from Colorado, well, the first thing was, we're fighting the Indians all the time, you know. And, of course, I'd just play it up. And my grandfather was Indian. And they wanted to know, well, how do you do out there? I said, well, of course he wasn't. I said, well, my grandfather's chief of the tribe, you know. And the guys from Denver, there was some in there, you know, and they just help along with them. There were so many phraseology I was used to. I just had no knowledge of the way they talked, and it was really confusing. In basic, we were in Biloxi, Mississippi. It was strange. I don't know how to put it, but having to go to a separate restroom or something like that, And I said, well, I'll be glad I get out of this place, you know. And then, of course, got to Tuskegee, and Tuskegee's really not in the town of Tuskegee. It's in a place called Greenwood. It's a suburb. And if you went to Tuskegee, the town, the atmosphere was much different. You could just feel it, you know. But out in Greenwood, you just didn't see any whites. Of course, now when we got to, and our instructor were all black. But then when we got to the air base, started in basic and advanced, all of those were whites. And a lot of them are from the north, so they weren't too bad.
And, you know, with the lens of history, we can look back now and say that what all of you did during World War II, the African-American soldiers, sailors, airmen, who risked their lives, laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement, that they showed our blood is just as red as any other American, that if we can die for our country, we deserve some rights. We say that now, but did you guys have a sense then that there was something you had a chance to prove?
Now, I don't know about the rest of the group, but I didn't feel that I had anything to prove. I knew what I could do, and I had learned to fly before I even went there, and they cautioned me here, never mention that you know how to fly. So I didn't, and an airplane was just as normal as an automobile to me. So my mindset was not as the others.
Well, you hadn't dealt with the degree of prejudice in your life that they had, I guess.
No, and the other thing is, I felt much different than most of them because I just didn't seem to think like they thought, you know. I was practically raised with white people, you know, and they used to say that, what do they call it? Say that you're an Oriole, you're dark on the outside and white on the inside. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's true, but I didn't realize it.
You said people here in Colorado Springs warned you when you get to Tuskegee, don't tell them you already know how to fly. Why did they tell you that? What was the concern?
The concern was that they would expect more out of me, or they may make it harder on me because, you know, I'm a smart aleck. That's the way I interpreted it, but I didn't tell them.
What all did you get to fly while you were there?
I got to fly the Stearman biplane, which was really a lot of fun, open cockpit and all like that, the real flying. Mm-hmm. And then I got to fly the Volte Vibrator, as they called it. It was a BT-13 made by Volte. Then the T-6, of which I really enjoyed flying the T-6. It was very maneuverable. Well, the Stearman was renewable, but it was sluggish and slow, you know.
And the T-6 is to prepare you to go overseas, and I'm sure you had ideas of flying one of those red-tailed P-51s, but that's not how it worked out.
No, just before graduation, I knew that I had my uniform, officer's uniform, and everything was hanging in the closet, you know, and I had a real nasty head cold, but I loved flying that T-6, and I said, well, I'll go to the dispensary after this flight. Well, I did, with blood coming out of my ears, you know. And of course, now that little incident just ruined my flying career. But I did get into a lot of flying, but not commercial type, because after I got out, but I got into maintenance and engineering and things like that, and had a fairly successful life, I'd say.
Well, yeah, and you're not done. In fact, now you've got this new book out that people everywhere are reading and learning some of this history. And I know part of the reason you wrote that book is to inspire young people, including those who battle dyslexia, as you did. But with the situation with that flight, where you just couldn't resist going up in that T-6 and you ruptured both eardrums, is that what happened?
Both of them, yeah. Uh-huh. And I was deaf for several weeks and in the hospital at the Scott Field, and then they sent me to radio code school, which brought a lot of my hearing back.
I'm just interested, because, you know, everybody has challenges in their life. Everybody faces adversity. It's hard when you don't know where the finish line is or where the light at the end of the tunnel is. And when here you've described how much you loved flying, and now all of a sudden not only can you not fly, you can't even hear for weeks on end. What was that time period like? What was going through your mind?
I got to get better. Was the best thing. And I guess I'm a fighter, you know, and I don't dwell on what could be, and I dwell on what's going to be. And I'm still the same way. The war was over with when I finally got out of the hospital. But they sent me back to Tuskegee to finish up with another class. But when it happened, the war was over with, and they said I'd have to re-up because my time was real close of getting out. And I thought about it a while, and I said, oh, I know, I don't put up with this grade of service. I can go home. I know how to fly. So that's it, and I'll make it. But in retrospect, I can say I should have done it, but that was should have, I didn't. But they're bugging me to write another book about what I did do after I got out of the military, because I was kind of involved in a lot of science things and research programs, things like that. And I don't know what I can write and can't write because I don't know how much is still secret and what is.
Sadly, some of those secrets went to the grave with Tuskegee Airman Frank Macon. That is a grave I'm going to make sure I visit the next time I'm in Colorado Springs. Frank received special permission to be buried on the grounds of the U.S. Air Force Academy. I was serious when I mentioned his book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, The Making of a Tuskegee Airman, would make a great Christmas gift, especially for a young person in your life. So I have that book linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And the story of how that book came about is pretty intriguing, too. We'll hear that from the woman who helped make it a reality when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Remembering a few of those heroes who were sorely missed at the Thanksgiving table this year, including Tuskegee Airman Frank Macon, who passed away this week at the age of 97. Interviews he did here and elsewhere preserve his legacy, and so does his book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, The Making of a Tuskegee Airman. Liz Harper co-wrote that book with Frank, and she explained to us the unique way that all came about.
I was at the Griffith Center, which is for troubled and adjudicated kids at the time. And I thought, well, I'll have Frank come speak. And so he did. He went multiple times. And I knew the kids were always mesmerized by him. Even these kids who normally wouldn't sit for 5 minutes would sit and listen to Frank tell these stories for like an hour and a half and not even move. So that always struck me as well. And then at that dinner, Chris said, we have to get Frank in the air again. He's going to be 92. And I thought, well, we live at the Air Force Academy. I should be able to figure that out. So we made some phone calls, and they just took it and ran. The Academy gave Frank a birthday flight, and then he spoke to all the freshman history classes. And then they introduced him at Mitchell Hall in front of all 3,000-plus cadets to a standing ovation. And I drove him that day, and on the way home, he said, all those reporters, everybody, whenever we do an event, they want me to write a book. And I said, well, why don't you, Frank? And he says, well, I'm dyslexic. And I just said, well, you want some help? And we started the next week, and here we are 4 years later with a book in hand and a great friendship, and just it's gone from there. So that's kind of how the whole thing happened. It was really quite providential. Frank has never let anything get in his way. And the other thing, even in the midst of things that were not always easy for him as a kid, like the dyslexia, not knowing his mom and dad, the racial elements of growing up in that time frame, Frank does not have an angry bone in his body. He so wants to leave a legacy and help kids, and he doesn't care if you're rich, you're poor, you're black or white, purple, green, he would say, it doesn't matter. He wants to help those kids, and he says, you can't listen to what other people are telling you. God gave you a purpose. You have to find what you're good at, and you go for that. So that has always struck me, and I think it strikes the adults who are around him as well, because he could choose to be kind of bitter just because of some of his circumstances, but there isn't an angry or a bitter bone in his body.
Who is this book for, and what do you hope people get out of it when they read it?
Well, by trade, I'm a teacher, and Frank wanted to help kids. So when we sat down and purposely, he's had so many interesting facts about history, but the goal was to really reach kids, to get them interested in history. Even kids who wouldn't normally pick up a book, it's written as if Frank's talking to a class, so it's great for a teacher or a grandparent or a parent to read to a child. And our goal was just to help kids find their niche, find a purpose, never to quit. And I know that kind of maybe sounds cliche, but Frank has had so many, you know, interactions with famous people. He's related to Frederick Douglass. His grandpa was a Buffalo soldier. You know, so all these things happened around him, and it didn't even faze him. He just knew he wanted to fly, and he was going to fly, and so be it. I mean, he jumped off the chicken coop, like I said, and all kinds of things. So our goal then, we sat down and decided to focus the book to the middle reader, which is like fourth grade through eighth grade. Adults really like it as well. But that was when Frank struggled the most in school, so that's the age group we targeted, because he wants to help kids who struggle with school. I'm just grateful for our friendship. You know, we've spent so much time. I'm just grateful for my kids. I get choked up talking about my son's birthday is the same day as Frank's. And what a blessing. You know, my 14-year-old gets to hang out with a World War II hero. And what do? They make parachutes together and throw them off the stairwell, because that's just who Frank is. He's so fun-loving. He's just a treasure. You know, that to me is more important than whatever comes of all these events and the book. Sorry, I get kind of emotional, but it just really is so amazing to me. I hope that people just realize what a privilege that generation is, and we're short on time. And I hope that they spend some time, if they know somebody of that age group, just sit and visit with them. They're just amazing. You know, it's hard to even put in words, really, but really, by the grace of God, our families cross paths, and it's just been a treasure for all of us.
And now we have this book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, that I'm sure many who are listening right now are going to order and treasure themselves. That was Liz Harper, who wrote the book with Frank, and I promised you more of Frank, The Legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen. How do you explain it? What gives you the most pride when it comes to being associated with that legendary group?
Well, I could say that they proved the people really, really wrong that was against us. And unfortunately, Lindbergh was one of the top people that was against us learning to fly. In later years, I've heard guys come up to me that said, you know, I was flying a B-17, and you, were you one of those guys? You saved my life. And all like that. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't one of them, but I know some of the guys that were. I'm afraid that would have been very hard to control, because, you know, if I'd have seen an enemy airplane, I would have probably broke formation and went out after them. But most of the guys stayed right, like Davis said, you stick right with those bombers. And the fighters were intermingled with the bombers so that the fighters couldn't get in. They were the first to shoot down that jet that they...
The German ME-262?
Yeah. At meetings, some of them would laugh about how they did it. Yeah, they would tease it, keep it up, because they knew the fuel consumption was right pretty terrible, and they'd keep it up until it ran out of fuel. And, of course, then it was a glider, so they could get it, you know. They quit sending them up after those. When they knew the red tails were there, they just forget it. They didn't bother.
Well, and you mentioned that you go out to the academy and talk to cadets. You've written this book to tell your story, and in ways the story of the Tuskegee Airmen as well. In all your associations with other Tuskegee Airmen over the years, what have you drawn from that?
Well, the association, and to know that they suffered... Or I suffered some of the embarrassments that they did. Some of those guys, when they got off the ship and come back, they had the sign colored on this side and whites on that side, you know. And the officers' club, a lot of them, they couldn't go in there until finally these guys found out that these are the guys who are saving our lives. And then the officers forced them to let them come into the officers' club.
You were already out of the service when this happened, but when you heard that President Truman was integrating the armed forces, that segregation, as far as our military was concerned, was no more, what did that mean to you?
Well, I was ready to go back in, and as I was saying, I was working out at Carson, and this colonel just said, no, you're not, and he got me out of it because I had the papers to go back in. I was in the reserves.
Well, as you said, you spent decades working on airplanes. You know, I don't know how much you can talk about there because you said some of it may still be secret. But one of the things I read about you, that you helped with modifications and improvements on a lot of different airplanes, and that you even became an accident investigator and suggested some changes that may save lives as far as air travel is concerned?
Yeah, that when I got out of Fort Carson, a research company here, and it was made up of ex-cadets from the Air Force Academy. There was an aircraft at a DC-3 that went into the seawall in Boston. From the FAA, they got the contract to try to determine what caused the accident. I got the records from the FAA, and I read them over and got thinking about it, and I said, well, the new pilots learn to fly instruments and learn, and they're told that you trust the instruments and not your feelings, at which old pilots, that instrument panel could be blank, as far, you know, and they trusted their senses, you know. So I said that something went wrong with the instrument. I got the autopilot, a model of it, and got it in the lab, and I said, well, this thing's working all right. It can't. And I got to thinking, you start at the accident and work back, and that was what I was taught. So I went back, and I finally figured out that there must have been something in the electrical system that overloaded it and wiped out the autopilot, and they thought they were at the 500-foot descent or whatever they had set for descent speed, and the needle was sitting right on there, and so they just said, well, we're okay. But it was a real heavy fog, and why radar didn't pick it up, I don't know. And of course, that wasn't what I was supposed to look for.
Right.
So I just figured it was somewhere in the electrical system. So they got to checking that, and the alternator regulator went out on them. And that's what happened.
So because of that electrical issue, their computerized or automatic altimeter was giving them a reading that was inaccurate. They thought they had more space.
Yeah. And so then they got busy and corrected that system.
Well, and just so I understand clearly, the situation with the airliner in Boston that crashed, and that crash killed everyone aboard the plane,
yeah.
You through your detective work, figure out what had gone wrong. The fix prevents that from happening again. So in theory, your determination and your skill in deciphering that saved a lot of lives.
Oh, well, yeah, I've thought about that and said, well, you did do something.
Yeah. Well, and you've hinted that you did a lot more, but some of it may still be classified. Are there any hints you can give us, some general ideas of the kind of stuff you're working on?
Well, a lot of laser stuff. The way it was set up, I was presented with one problem, and I overcame that. The guy in the next office was given a problem, and all of this, and I don't know, some lab in Mississippi probably got something else, and then this was all taken to some place like Kirtland Air Force Base, and they put all this information. So I don't know what I...
So they had to separate different elements of the project so no one would know all of it.
That's why I can't say what it was, because I don't know.
All right.
But I knew some of it had to do with lasers. You know, when I was coming along, the Negro family, people would say, oh, the white folks won't let us do this, and the white folks won't. And it was the white folks that was pushing me to do these things. So I didn't listen to them. They just didn't want to do it, that's all. They just rather complain than get it done. I never was. I'll complain about something, but it's... You know, but I always find a way that I can get around that situation. I can say I've had a lot of help, and that was, I think, my curiosity is what people were interested in, to help me. And I help myself. I don't stand around, well, I can't do this, and I can't do that. No, by the time they can't do it, I've got it done. You know, that's just the way I am. And I depend on me to get her done. People say, well, you're 96. Well, you want to be doing that. Oh, get out of my way. I can get to, you know. By the time you try to do something for me, I've got it done.
Well, then maybe you're the guy to ask this question, because I'm just thinking, I hear your perspective, and correct me if I'm wrong, but even though you are aware of the segregated military, you didn't think that was right, your lens wasn't always focused on racial issues. That wasn't your priority or focus.
I don't have time to be focusing on that and complaining and all like that. Yeah. You know, but I just get and do it.
So I'm just curious, because in today's world, even though our military is integrated and the civil rights movement has happened, there's still, in the news, you hear about racial tensions and you hear the verbal volleys being fired back and forth. What advice do you have for all of us in navigating that? What do you think could help us get it right?
Shut up and get something done. And quit complaining and quit looking at that, because I don't look at a white person. I do not look at a, quote, black person. And those terminologies, I have never seen a white person in my life, and I've never seen a black one. You take a piece of paper, a white, and put your hand on her, you're not white. I take that same black piece of paper and put it on her, and this color and dividing people up by color or something like that is stupid, just absolutely stupid.
You know what I didn't ask you, because, I mean, all your time in the air, did you ever have some scares, some close calls, some moments where you weren't sure if that landing was going to go quite right?
Flying is many moments of boredom, all shared by a few split seconds of sheer terror. I was in a real serious helicopter crash at Carson. We took off and flew around, and he put the engine at idle to come into the land, and it quit. Engine, I said, well, you got rotor speed. Just keep your rotor speed up. We'll be all right. And, of course, you know, when you get close to the ground, you call what they call a collective, and it changes the pitch of the blades, and you get a cushion, and you just sit down. And it's no problem. And he said, you think we should go around again? And that little small voice in my head said no. But I said, yeah, let's give it another go. This time the engine caught, and then it quit again, and he panicked, and he pulled the collective in too high and killed all the energy in the blades, and we hit like a ton of rock, and it rolled up, and it was a type of helicopter that you see on MASH. It rolled over or hit a mud puddle. It had been raining, and it hit a mud, the skid hit a mud puddle and flipped over and landed on my the side I was on, of course. But there was a hole where some of the instruments went through the bubble, and it was happened to be in the summertime. We didn't have the doors on there. That's another thing. Lucky, and we jumped out and come out there. But I got bruised up, but I didn't get break anything. I got bruised up pretty bad. In fact, I've got an ankle that lets me know that it's still around. But anyway, I had plenty of time, civil service time, and so they gave me a medical retirement from that. And that's how I got away from Carson. And while I was recovering, that's when I got that job with the research company.
How do you explain your story? Because I'm just thinking about it. A kid born to a teenage mother, raised by his aunts, struggles to read, looks at the page and the numbers and the letters are all over the place, and it's detective work just to try to figure out what's said there, that he could learn to fly as a teenager, be part of a legendary group of pilots known as the Tuskegee Airmen, do life-saving research on the highest-tech aeronautical machines in the country. That doesn't sound like a story that unfolds every day. How do you explain it?
Well, I'm not a what you call a religious person, but saying that, I do believe in a supreme being, and I think that this supreme being said, this is going to be your job, mister, and get it done.
He got it done for 97 years. That was the late Frank Macon. With his passing this week, only about four dozen Tuskegee Airmen are still with us. Again, his book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot, is linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. I know it can seem kind of somber on those rare occasions when we listen back to stories from veterans who have passed, but it's also a powerful reminder of the importance of preserving the stories of those who remain. So let that be an encouragement to you this holiday season. If you're able to spend some time with an aging veteran in your life, why not ask a few questions? Be patient and be prepared to hear a thing or two you've never heard before. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.